starting to roll here. Hello, everybody. Welcome. It is actually, we are live from the White House. Oh, it is April Fool's Day. So, hey, welcome to the Energy Realities Podcast. We have an outstanding show for you today. And we have, first up, around the corner, Tammy Nemeth with the Nemeth Report. Tammy, welcome. And you're from the UK this morning, right?
Yeah, I'm in the UK today.
Oh, and you're not traveling very far. So then we have Irina Slav. She is an energy expert authoress, and she is in Bulgaria. How are you this morning? I'll tell you, I got to have some more coffee here this morning. And then we have the David Blackman. I mean, David is a contributing Forbes author, a Substack author, He's busy about town, and I think, David, welcome. How are you today?
Oh, I'm just thrilled to be here, man. I've been up since 2:30 this morning. It's terrible.
Well, Irina and Tammy and I had paid for somebody to stalk you this past weekend on your sugar rush. So with that, let's go ahead and bring in your sugar rush when you are hiding your own Easter eggs. Let's play this here. This is David Blackman.
That does look like me, doesn't it? eating all those jelly beans that my grandkids brought in there, those plastic eggs.
Oh, man. All right. So with that, let's go ahead and tee up our show for today. And we've got I can't say this. I sound like Scooby-Doo when I try to say this, but what are we talking about? Carbon taxes and rebates.
Klimageld.
Thank you. All right. First up around.
Is that a German word? Wait a second. Is that a German word?
That's a German word. Yeah. It's okay. So if I can just provide a little bit of context there, when the Socialist Party, the SPD, was running in their campaign, one of their platform principles was Klimageld, and that is basically a carbon tax rebate for the citizens. And in the coalition that they're in, they said they would bring it in, and they haven't brought it in yet. And so there was a question, I think last year in the German parliament, asking, when are we going to get our Klimageld? And the German government said, they gave a subsidy cut already or whatever. There is a 6.5 cent per kilowatt hour surcharge that every German utility payer had to pay in order to pay for the subsidies to wind and solar over a 20-year period. And they lifted that in 2022, with the Ukraine attack and whatnot. And so they're like, well, we've already given you a whole bunch of money and whatnot. So that's where we're at right now, where they're still demanding, especially the environmental groups want, various groups want the Klimageld.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the environmentalist groups that are made up mainly of upper middle class people who can afford it.
Right. Well, and the reason I sort of talked about this, suggested this topic, was that today is April 1st, and the Canadian carbon tax increase is 23% today. And
wow.
Yeah. So
23%.
Yeah. Increase. So they give a subsidy supposedly to some people, not everybody, some people based on, I don't know what income, if you're a retired person or whatever, then you get a carbon tax rebate check. But people aren't, they're saying, oh, more people get more money back. And they don't. Because what's interesting, if I can just add one thing, in Canada with the carbon tax, it gets charged on your utility bill. And depending on which province you're in, it gets charged differently because some provinces have their own system or something. But they charge the goods and services tax, which is the federal sales tax, on top of it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
So you don't get a rebate on that, but you get a rebate on the original, supposedly. Well,
Tammy, your neck, let's go here. Is this what you were talking about on this right here?
Right. And so 7 of the Canadian premiers wrote the prime minister and said, can you just stop increasing it, right? Can we just not have another increase? Because they increase every year by 23% until at 2030, it'll be $170 a ton or something some ridiculous Whoa. Number. I think right now it's at 85. It increased to 85 yes. or something. So the seven premiers said, can we stop it? And the prime minister wrote back and said, no, if you want to stop it, give a different alternative. And it's like, okay, whatever. And so then the federal prime leader of the opposition put a motion forward in the House to stop the carbon price tax increase. And every party except the Conservatives voted against it. So we have the Liberals, which are socialist light. We have the full socialists, the New Democrat Party, the Greens, of course, and the Bloc Québécois, which is a French separatist party. They all voted against that motion. So they all want the carbon tax. And so the newest push is that economists have been pressured in Canada, academic ones, to sign an open letter supporting a carbon tax. So I think there are up to 200 or 300 economists who have signed this letter saying that, yay, carbon taxes are great. Well, with a university job, I guess they don't have to worry so much about paying it.
Wow. Now, there was a video that there was a cat on there that was the Tammy, I'm not sure how much of this you bring it up here, but let you control
more political hay at the expense of Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault.
Okay, so Stephen Guilbeault, who's the Environment Minister in Canada, he is also he used to be involved in Greenpeace, and then he helped set up an offshoot of Greenpeace, a Quebec version called Équateur. And he was the head of Équateur for a long time before he was sort of parachuted into a position with the Liberal Party. And one of the things that he did when he was an activist was he scaled the CN Tower. He was charged with criminal activity, whatever they call it nowadays. He also scaled the Premier of Alberta's house and installed solar panels, or tried to install solar panels without permission, and intimidated the wife and all this kind of thing, and got put in jail for that. And so this is the same guy who's telling the Premier of Saskatchewan he's acting in a criminal way, which is hilarious. But so yeah, that's Stephen Guilbeault there, and he's a bit of a interesting character.
Guilbeault had been quoted in February saying the federal government would no longer invest in new roads. He subsequently corrected himself to say he meant there would be no federal money for a car tunnel in Quebec. But his political opponents were not going to let him off that easy.
So this seems to be a war on cars. This has been the plan all along. And so what Minister Guilbeault did was just say the quiet part out loud.
My comments were specifically related to the project in Quebec.
Guilbeault is a favorite target of Conservatives because he is the chief evangelist for the carbon tax.
So if you don't understand how the carbon tax affects road infrastructure, I can't help you. But I have a question for you. Is there anything that you would do to walk back, you personally, would you walk back in any case the 23% carbon tax increase in April?
Guilbeault would only defend the carbon tax in French.
Noting
that, yes, while the carbon tax does go up April 1st, so does the rebate paid to most Canadians.
Meanwhile, a new report came out Thursday to give Guilbeault and the Liberals a bit of cover over carbon pricing. The Canadian Climate Institute said that the fuel surcharge, the carbon tax, paid by consumers will indeed play an important role in getting Canada to net zero emissions. But the Institute said industrial carbon pricing systems on large emitters, that's what's in place in Alberta, will make the single biggest contribution to cutting emissions.
Wow.
So the Canadian Climate Institute is an organization set up by the federal government, and it's filled with a lot of activists. So, you know, when I hear these supportive statements from organizations that were either established by the federal government, get a lot of money from federal government, also get a lot of money from foundations that have a vested interest in pursuing this agenda, it kind of throws into question the credibility, I think.
Tammy,
anyway,
So in the upcoming elections, I keep seeing polls that Trudeau is badly trailing Poilievre in public opinion polls. But isn't it a case because of the parliamentary system. Unless the Conservative Party is able to win a pure majority in the parliament, there's every chance that Trudeau could get 20% of the vote, say, and still continue to reign.
He only has 32% of the vote right now. That's what he got elected on the last one, right?
Yeah, and you have these other parties as his coalition. So even if he only gets 25% this time, say, he could still end up having another term as prime minister, couldn't he? Or is he term limited out?
No, there's no term limit. So it's like definitely he could form another coalition. It all depends on the distribution of the seats because, you know, like it's sort of like the United States where you have certain areas, particularly in Ontario and Quebec, that have a lot of seats. And then when you get out west, there's not as many seats. And so even though Poilievre might get 90% of the vote in Western Canada or some, you know, ridiculously high number, that only translates into, you know, not the same number of seats that you would get in Ontario and Quebec or whatever. Yeah. So I think the other issue with any upcoming election is that the federal government has just put in tabled legislation that's going to change our election system. And I'm not really sure. I haven't looked through it yet, but I've heard some other commentators who are quite concerned about the changes that are being proposed. But I don't want to say too much about it because I haven't read it yet. But it could be concerning.
But are there so many people in those most populated provinces that want their life to get more expensive?
Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, it depends on who you talk to and how it's framed, right? Because on the one hand, there's the very clear indication that the carbon tax makes everything more expensive because it's charged on everything. So if all of your energy is now 30% higher, and that goes into transportation, into processing, into just keeping the lights on in, say, a supermarket or whatever, all of those things get amplified throughout the economy, but they only talk about it being implemented in one place. And so the Bank of Canada, which has produced these sort of assessment numbers about the cost of the carbon tax or its impact on inflation, the number is incredibly low because they only take into account it being applied once. But if you see that it's being applied at every point throughout your economic chain, it increases like compound interest. Yeah. So for a bank to not be able to take into account what essentially is like compound interest throughout the economy, I don't think they're doing Canadians a service at all.
My goodness.
But this is what they want to bring in globally.
Right, exactly. And it's the goal, of course, is to make energy more expensive and to force you to live smaller lives and conserve and do with less energy. That's what the goal of it all is. Yeah.
And then they put that money into a pot so they can choose winners and losers. And I think that's one of the biggest distortions out there is that you now have government deciding which company ought to succeed and which companies ought to be penalized. And that is not a market or democratic based system. As far as I'm concerned,
it's not at all.
But so one of the reasons, if I can just want to add one thing, one of the reasons why I think they can't remove it is because Canada is leading this group, this voluntary group, in order to implement a global carbon tax. So how could they possibly lead a group that's trying to push every other country in the world to do this? How could they lead that if they ended up having to scrap it ourselves? Right. So
right.
From an ego perspective, I think it would be very difficult for the Canadian government to back down now. They just have to double down.
Well, I have to say that changing the way the elections are conducted, a proposal like that shouldn't surprise anyone because that's just the next step here is to, you know, when we've been optimistic, I think, that the people would push back in the Western world against these policies, right? And we've seen elections in Europe and other parts of the world that where democracy is rather still pure, like in Argentina, where you have a real democracy, a pure democracy, then the people can rise up and change the government. But where you have these very complex systems with a majority that is focused on maintaining control, it's not surprising that their next step will become to change the way the elections are conducted. In America, we've had all these things like vote harvesting and mail-in ballots that literally change the way the votes are counted.
Yeah.
Right. And as Lenin always said, or maybe it was Stalin, it doesn't really matter who votes. What matters is who counts the votes.
Yeah.
Who's counting. And you know, we saw in the Netherlands where you had a conservative party technically win the election, but can't form a coalition in the parliament to actually form a government. And so these are potentialities that these folks on the far left have thought of and have planned for. And so it doesn't really surprise me that Trudeau's party is trying to literally change the way the elections are conducted.
Well, and it's quite shocking because I have friends who sometimes work at polling stations when there's an election, and you could only vote at the booth wherever that it said so on your polling card, and they want to change that so you can vote anywhere in the riding. Yeah. So, you know, how are they going to cross-reference that afterwards? Let's say if someone were to be nefarious and vote in 3 or 4 different polling stations in their riding, how are you going to cross-reference and remove those extra votes or something? I mean, it just opens, and they want to add in more mail-in voting and stuff like that, and over, so that it's not one day, but it's like a week of voting. I mean, this is bad from what I've read. But
we vote for a month in America now, you know.
Yeah, like, really?
And it's almost impossible to police the mail-in ballots, and when you allow people to just vote anywhere.
Yeah,
you're right. I mean, it makes it virtually impossible to police multiple voting. And that's the goal. I mean, that's the reason why they make those proposals.
Well, how do they do it in Bulgaria, Irina? How do they do their voting?
Oh, we vote, you know, personally. We show up at the polling station and vote either by machine or by paper.
Do you have to have an ID?
Yeah, you have to have an ID. The ID is compared to a list of names for people who are registered for voting in this place. There was some scandal about machine voting because the machines apparently could be rigged. I'm not sure I understand this because I voted with a machine and it, you know, it spits out a note that says what party I voted for. But apparently you can manipulate them, maybe, you know, vote a lot more times. From, I don't know, on behalf of dead people or something. I don't know. I don't understand any of this. But we do vote personally. Yeah. Our problem is very low turnout.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same in the UK. In the UK, there's no machines. You just go with you get a piece of paper and you go in and you mark your X, but you have to show up. You have a polling card. You have to show up to the station that says that you're supposed to go to. And then they check your card, you show ID, and they mark you as having, you know, check you off kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, like, why can't, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with doing it that way?
Too much hassle. I don't know.
I don't know.
Tammy, was this your other one? Have you already covered that?
I covered them both. So
okay, great.
Yeah, we can
and then rolling over here before we get banned and shut down because of racist comments from David Blackman. I'm sorry, David. What? Did I just say that out loud?
What?
Well, you know, voter ID is racist, according to David Blackman. Okay, so we have Irina Slav over in Bulgaria.
Oh, it isn't.
No, it's not. I agree with you. It's a joke, David. Good morning.
Oh, okay.
We have Irina, and you've got two great stories here.
Yeah. The latest from the transition. EU hits roadblocks in reaching green milestone as elections loom. The problem of the EU is it cannot build all the wind and solar it has to build. fast enough to hit its own targets. They are, you know, they're recognizing that it is impossible. It is physically impossible to do it. But they're hopeful. It can be done. They don't know how. You know, the climate commissioner by the name of Wopke, he, as long as they do a bit of homework, you know, member states should just do a bit of homework and find a way to build all this new capacity. How? We don't know. But there's a good chance that we'll still hit that emission reduction target of 55% from 1990 or something by 2030. Yeah. Good luck to them. Until they answer the how part of the question, it's not happening. I mean, even Germany can't hit its own targets. And then we have more pain from the hydrogen industry, the green hydrogen industry in the United States, because apparently a lot of projects cannot qualify for the biggest, the fattest subsidy. Because it is so ridiculous. It basically, this subsidy stipulation, it says you need to produce your green hydrogen from wind and solar only, but we're not going to say this directly. But the requirements they've put in place include the following. The hydrogen, the green hydrogen, must be produced from energy sources in the same area as the electrolysis plant. Okay, should be produced locally. It must be produced from, what was it, energy sources that are producing the electricity around the same time as the green hydrogen is produced.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
And what was the third one? Let me just check. Oh, and they have to prove all this.
Prove?
Oh, yes, they have to. And it has to come from sources that were recently built. So you can't use nuclear power from a plant that was built 30 years ago. And all this has to be proved, which obviously cannot happen. And there are some companies who want to produce green hydrogen by using nuclear or landfill gas, biogas, which I think should be fine, but it's not.
You know, Irina,
such a restrictive regime, obviously aimed at encouraging more wind and solar.
Wind and solar.
But there comes a point where, you know, somebody is going to do their homework, unlike you member states, because that's an impossible homework. And they're going to drop their investment plans for green hydrogen. If they're not getting the top subsidy, they will need to spend a lot of money.
Yeah.
And return is not guaranteed. So, yeah.
You know, Irina,
you can't use nuclear. Like, really?
No.
After I saw the story and what you're bringing this up, I don't know why. I think Google was listening to our conversation, but again, all of a sudden, all these hydrogen stories started coming over across my screen and everything else. And the one that it really got me tickled, Irina, was the fact that they now say hydrogen airplanes, and they had designs that were coming up for hydrogen. I'm sorry, the Hindenburg happened for a reason, right? And they had hydrogen planes, and the main center of the entire thing of the plane was a very densely compacted hydrogen storage tank in the middle of this thing. Why would you want to sit on top of a hydrogen bomb and pretend it's green? I'm not going to be flying on that thing. The technology was horrible. Sorry.
Well, you know, it's kind of like communism, right? They just didn't do it right the last time.
Of course.
They do it better now. Yeah.
Well, so do the hydrogen better this time. It won't explode quite as badly.
Yeah, it's not so combustible anymore.
I actually am a hydrogen fan from a technology standpoint. I love the idea, but implementation of hydrogen's tough and expensive. David, I think you've got some ones coming around the corner here.
These are not mine.
Oh, they're not?
They're yours. These are yours. Do them.
I knew that. Which one are yours? Is that yours?
That is not mine. Wait, go back.
Oh, yeah,
back,
yeah, because it has the port. Yeah. It has the port.
The energy impacts from the port.
You had too much sugar because I thought these were yours.
Nope. But right. I can talk about them. I mean, I one of mine was to talk about gas prices and why they're fast rising, and they're going to keep rising because we're doing the changeover from winter blends to summer blends right now, and a lot of the refining capacity is going offline for periodic maintenance, as it does every spring, to get ready for the summer driving season. This always happens in the United States, but mainly it's because oil prices keep going up, and they're going up because supply is not adequate to meet demand, and everybody knows it. A lot of that has to do with the OPEC plus cuts. Some of it has to do with suddenly falling overall oil production in the United States shale patch. Finally, the dropping rig count appears to be catching up with the ability of the industry to maintain overall production. We're not drilling enough wells, enough new wells to make up for the decline rate in the wells that are already producing. And so the EIA is projecting that January's production will be significantly down from December's. And there's no telling where that goes this year. But if the United States ends up losing 500,000 barrels a day this year in overall production instead of increasing by another 500,000, that's 1 million barrels a day difference in the global market. And that either has to be made up by spare capacity in OPEC plus, and there's only a few countries in OPEC plus that have spare capacity to add, or we're going to have a really big price increase the second half of the year because
they have to want it.
Right. That's right. Yeah. They have to want it. And, you know, OPEC plus says its goal is to maintain Brent at 80 or above right now. But it's at 87 and nobody's increasing production to try to calm that down. Right. So I think we're going to have pretty high gas prices this summer in the United States. Summer driving season will kick in mid-May. And that means a lot of additional demand. It's going to put a lot of additional stress on refiners here in the United States.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think we could have $5 a gallon gasoline prices again in the United States this summer. So everybody better buckle up and get ready. The Baltimore thing, you know, my commentary on that was just that in the wake of that, you know, of course, I mean, it's everybody's feeling terrible for the people of Baltimore and the people at that port. A lot of jobs are going to be lost as the ship traffic remains blocked by that collapsed bridge. It's a terrible event, and it's going to have major economic impacts up and down the East Coast of the United States. It's also going to mess up some supply chains across the breadth of the country as well. But in the wake of that, I went out and found the data on what are the biggest ports in the United States, because everybody kept talking about how Baltimore is the second most active port on the East Coast, which it is. But when you look at the country as a whole, it's only the 17th most active port in terms of total tonnage going in and out of it. And most of the biggest ports are along the Gulf Coast in Texas and Louisiana, particularly Houston, Corpus Christi, and what they call the Port of Louisiana, which is really several ports that are clustered together near the mouth of the Mississippi River. And, you know, that just points out how vital the oil trade is globally, because the ports of Corpus Christi and Houston, when you add up the total tonnage going out of Houston, Corpus Christi, and the Port of Louisiana, it's more than every non-Texas Louisiana port on that list combined, okay? Just those three ports. And most of it going in and out of Houston and Corpus Christi is crude oil imports and exports, whereas the Port of Louisiana is staging area for about 90% of the offshore oil and gas drilling operations in the Gulf of Mexico. It's where all those ships are staged, all that equipment goes back and forth. All that traffic goes in and out of that port. And what it points to is just emphasizes again the fact, and you know, I'm sure most of the audience for this podcast knows it already, that oil is the most traded commodity on the face of the earth and has been for 120 years and will continue to be probably for another 100 years from today. And none of those ships could go in and out of Baltimore or New York. Somebody made the point when I posted that on my Substack. Well, you know, but that's oil traffic. It's not container traffic. And my point was, well, none of that container traffic is going to go anywhere without oil, right? Because all those ships are powered by diesel. And it just points out to the vital nature of the oil trade globally and how it just powers the whole economy. And that's my preachiness for today.
There's a couple key points in that Baltimore article in there, and that is coal. It's the number one export for the port out of there. And India is the number one in 2023 for theirs. Now, the pricing has not gone
India
up.
India is the number one importer from U.S.?
Yes, from that amount of coal. And Egypt was in there and Canada was also in there as well too. So, when you take
Canada,
Canada, you know, I love Canada, especially when I go to hockey games and stuff, you know, and I don't know how to sing the Canadian, oh, Canada. That's all I can sing is just, oh, Canada.
That's almost all Canadians can sing as well. It's like, oh,
that's like going to Oklahoma State football game. Nobody knows the fight song of our university except O-S-U. Okay. Now, but when you take a look at coking coal or metallurgical coal or steam coal, there's the two different kinds that are in there. I just read an article that was amazing about the bridge itself and the impact for the tax. I believe it was Irina and others have brought this up, is that that bridge covers an access for propane, for gasoline, for diesel, for everything else that is now having to be rerouted and going around. So that bridge is very critical. So it's going to be interesting. And then we had another bridge hit this weekend in Oklahoma. Yeah, go figure that out. And you gotta love it. Don't drive over bridges without looking both ways to see if there's a ship coming.
Luckily, that bridge in Oklahoma was a concrete bridge. It wasn't a cantilevered bridge like the Key Bridge in Baltimore. You know, that Key Bridge was a cantilevered bridge that just collapsed as soon as a big object hit that one support column. But the bridge going over that Oklahoma lake was a pure concrete, reinforced concrete bridge.
And don't be, we are all resting assured because Mayor Pete is on the job and they're now missing the 2 minutes right before the crash happened. And it's only going to take several years for them to find out what happened. But they came out and said right after, within 10 minutes of it hitting it, going, nothing to see here. It's not a terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Yeah.
All right.
3 years to investigate that.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's go to the next ones here. Let's go here. So this story I found pretty interesting on this. 20 U.S. Oil and gas trade groups unite against Biden's misguided methane fee. I'll tell you what. The full list is in the article. It is nice to see that oil and gas executives are standing up, and the trade associations, the API, they all do a great job, and they all have to get out there and really stand up for folks. This tax, this is a quote. This tax on American energy is a serious misstep that could jeopardize our nation's energy advantage and weaken our energy security, said API Senior Vice President Policy Dustin Meyer. Do you know Dustin?
I do not.
U.S. oil and gas is innovating throughout its operation to reduce natural methane emissions while meeting and growing energy demand. Yet this proposal creates an incoherent, confusing regulatory regime that will only stifle technology advancements and hamper energy development.
Can you explain what the methane fee is for those who maybe aren't aware?
The methane fee, it is coming in. So it's going to be any producing company, is going to be charged, it's a tax is basically all it is for methane. It's unbelievable.
So if it's leaking,
is it leaking? If it's leaking or there, they're now redirecting satellites over methane fields, and they're now saying if it's a oil and gas, methane happens naturally, and so what they're saying is the methane is going to be now through technology and satellites saying you owe this amount, but it's also going into scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3. The regulatory process and where it's going is just unbelievable.
Right. Okay. So my understanding is that they don't have that many satellites up right now to do methane. MethaneSat, which is a joint initiative with Environmental Defense Fund, where they got $32 million to pay for a satellite. I don't know. A charity.
Set
up a satellite. Yeah.
Right.
And there's issues with calibration because, as you say, it is naturally occurring. And it mixes in with the atmosphere. And when they're looking down with the satellite, it's not like they can just say, okay, methane's not moving in this space, right? I mean, it's circulating through the atmosphere and whatnot. And so I think I would want to know how they're calibrating those satellites before trusting such data.
And to be clear, it's not just done by satellite. I mean, there's the LIDAR cameras that EPA and state regulators have programs to police oil and gas production facilities and storage facilities. And the fee, it's charged to each ton of methane. Now, I'm reading here from a Baker Hostetler document on it. The charge applies to each metric ton of methane by which a facility exceeds a preset threshold. The charge is $900 a ton for 2024, $1,200 a ton for 2025, and $1,500 per ton thereafter, okay? And that's from every oil and gas production storage facility in the United States, and it's going to be an enormous amount of money. It is essentially a carbon tax on methane is how it's going to approach it. And it doesn't make any sense, and it's just that the camel's nose under a tent for a carbon tax. This was a tax. This tax was passed in the IRA, and it's crazy. And this will be the first thing if Donald Trump is elected. This will be one of the few elements of the IRA that will be repealed.
Can I put a plug in here for my podcast? I talked with Professors William Happer and Professor William Van Weingarten on last Monday and or Tuesday last week. In any event, they were talking about methane and what a non-issue it is. And so why did they go after a gas that is like a rounding error in our atmosphere, right? And they keep saying, oh, it's got this global warming potential, but it's only if you're comparing it molecule to molecule with carbon dioxide, which, you know, is arguable about what it's doing with the atmosphere and whatnot. But methane is really parts per billion. Yeah, there's hardly any methane out there. Yeah. And so, you know, to be just accepting that we need to do something about methane, I think is conceding a point that shouldn't be conceded in the first place.
Yeah, but of course it's all political. Everything's political. And the reason you go after methane is because you're trying to punish methane. You're trying to punish the industry that produces methane. You're trying to marginalize methane so that you can encourage the building of more wind and solar and all these non-viable alternatives to it. So, yeah.
And also bad natural gas, right? Because if you get the public to believe that methane is bad and evil or whatever, then it's much easier to convince them that, well, you shouldn't be using natural gas then.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't like where that's
going. Let's see here. Also, Secretary, this was something that you, China was,
best.
Yeah, China was, the EU, could you guys tell us what, the EU was going on with EU and China and EVs?
Cause this is investigating China for selling cheap EVs. That's what's happening. They can't have competition because the car makers need the market. So the EU is investigating.
Yeah.
But they're still allowing them on the market.
Yeah, I've got this video. Janet Yellen agreed to come on the podcast next Monday. And so this is the warm-up video of her getting ready to come on next Monday. So buckle up, everybody. This is Janet Yellen getting ready to come on the Energy Reality podcast. So let me get a good video started here. Here we go. Hello, Secretary Yellen. How are you this morning? Holy smokes. I think the bear's hair looks better than hers. I'm not sure.
Where is that poor bear?
I don't know. I felt so bad for him to accuse him of looking like Yellen. So I'm sorry, Mr.
Looks
Bear.
It's like a zoo.
Captain Poopy Pants. All right, Captain Poopy Pants. Captain Poopy Pants. All right. Anyway, so with that, let's go back to Irina. I think we got all your stories, David.
Yes.
I think we've gone through the stories here.
Yep, we have. Yeah. So what's coming around the corner in Irina, what do you see in your stories or what's coming around the corner for you?
Well, I don't know. I decide what to write about based on what I read. Every day brings a surprise. You know, that's the excitement.
Well, Tammy, how about you? What do you see coming around this week?
Well, I think the China EV issue is very fascinating because, like, for example, in the UK, they put a whole bunch of government money to set up BMW Mini EV plant in Oxford. And when the energy crisis hit in 2022, they said, oh, we can't afford to stay here anymore because we have to use all renewable energy or whatever. So they said they'd continue producing petrol minis at the Oxford plant until 2030 or whenever the ban is. And they moved the production line for the electric Mini to China. And later this year, they're going to start bringing in the Chinese-made Mini EVs into the British and European market. So, you know, they can complain about Chinese EVs. They're probably okay with it if China's making European versions. They just don't maybe want BYD. I don't know. As long as the European manufacturers are still getting some kind of money out of it.
Tammy, I just got an exclusive note here. They've got a new test track coming out for this EV. Here we go. They're just now rolling in. Check this out. They're testing that new EV.
I hope it doesn't explode in the water.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh.
I'm going to give him about a 10.5. What do you think?
That was pretty good. We need to have him in the Olympics this year.
No kidding. And he's even walking away from that bad dog.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. Tammy, that was pretty cool.
That's funny.
And David, what do you got coming around the corner?
Well, I want to close by just noting a couple of things about EVs. First, is that the threat of China's cheap EVs on the American market is what created the whole bloodbath controversy from President Trump's remark a a few weeks ago. And we all should take a look back and note how rapidly both the White House and its supporters in the news media dropped that subject because of the blowback from the public for just exactly how stupid it was. The second thing I want to know is that I saw a commercial over the weekend from Buick. And Buick is introducing in this next model year a new SUV. And guess what? It's a gas-powered SUV model. This is the first automaker I've seen introduce a new line of gas-powered cars in several years, you know, because they're supposed to be phasing all that out. Suddenly, Buick is introducing a new gas-powered SUV to the market. I think that's a very telling sign of what's to come. The third thing I want to point out to everyone is that Fisker announced on Friday it was cutting the price of its beautiful, and they are beautiful, SUV called the Ocean by 40%.
To avoid bankruptcy.
In their desperation to avoid bankruptcy, they're trying to clear their backlog of unsold cars. And so you can buy a car that last week would have cost you $62,000. You can buy it this week for $37,000. The only problem is that the company that made the car could be out of business before it makes the delivery if you go ahead and buy one. So I just think that these events are moving very rapidly in the whole EV market, and we're in for a lot of change on that front as this year goes on.
I got to give a handout to Toyota. You know, Toyota has been leading the what makes common sense to us, and that is I'm all about a hybrid. I like the idea of hybrid technology. Great. I'll pay a little bit more to get the extra miles per gallon. Yeah. And Toyota is really coming forward, and they're the anti Tesla, if you would, and they're doing great.
Can I add one thing? I know David had mentioned this on his Energy Absurdity last week, but the other issue to be looking forward to is the oil pipeline coming, the TMX pipeline that the government had to end up buying because this regulatory bottleneck. No one wanted to keep it, so the government bought the pipeline. The cost has ballooned because the environmentalists have tried to stop it every step of the way, which of course inflated the cost by like, you know, 10 times or whatever. So it's finally almost done. They're almost ready to start putting oil in there. I think they're pressurizing the line, and they're one of the prime markets for this oil is California. And Los that Angeles, oil yes. is coming from the oil sand. So all the Hollywood people who protested the Keystone XL pipeline because it would take oil sands oil down to the Gulf Coast to be refined for use either in America, North America, elsewhere, whatever, that was bad. But getting oil sands oil through a pipeline onto a tanker and down to the Port of Los Angeles or wherever it's going to be refined, that's okay, apparently.
That's- Hey, yes.
I'm waiting to see Jane Fonda chain herself to the refinery or something.
You know, you can't buy this kind of fun. And I think it's so wonderful that the heads are popping pow, 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 all over the West Coast. I mean, this is something you can't buy for entertainment.
Yeah, that story is just priceless. It's absolutely priceless.
Make me laugh.
All right. Well, with that, if you guys have any, Irina, you're Irina Slav at Substack.com. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And you're the Nemeth Report on where all podcasts are done. Correct, Tammy?
Yep.
All right. And David, and boy, that was a glad you went all out on that answer. Yep. And then we got David Blackman. And as for me, Blackmansubstack.com, and I am on the energynewsbeat.com. With that, let's have a great show and a great week, and we'll have some more fun next week. Thanks, guys.
Have a good week. See you all next week. Thank you. Bye.